Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Podcast. My name is Jasper Oorthuis. I'm the editor of Ancient Warfare Magazine, and with me are Mark DeSantis. And today, as a teammate and also special guest, we have Lindsay Powell, because we're going to talk about his new book. Lindsay, it's a name that apparently requires some explanation. So why don't you pronounce the title for us so we know how it should be done?
Well, thank you for calling me a teammate. I have to say, I feel like one. It's a brilliant group of guys. It's a wonderful product, the magazine. I'm thrilled. I'm actually part of the group of people that make it happen. When I do have some hours spare from doing that, I actually do write. And I've been fascinated by the figure of Bar Kochava. If you talk to modern Israelis, that's what they'll basically call him, Bar Kochava. But for the purpose of this exercise, let's just call him Bar Kochava. How does he get a name? Well, what we know is that is an adopted name. That's the name that history has sort of assigned him, and there's a history to go with that history. The name that we know he actually lived by was Shimon ben Koziba, with an S, actually, and that's significant. I'll explain that in a second. We know that because letters have been found in caves in the Dead Sea area, the cave specifically of Mura Abad, where some letters, one of which actually MUR, as it's called, 43, actually had a signature on it. So we know that he called himself Shimon. And what's interesting is the fact that Ben Koziba seems to be either a patronymic, so his dad may have been called Koziba, or he may have come from a place called Koziba, in which case there's potentially a candidate village that some people suggest. That the name Bar Kochba, curiously enough, seems to be recorded in the Christian histories, where you've got people, for example, like Justin Martyr and Eusebius, who refer to Bar Kochebas or Kochebas. They're writing in Greek, of course. So they seem to be preserving a name which was in currency. But Justin Martyr actually lives at the time of the 130s AD when all this happens. And the name Bar Kochba seems to be the, if you like, the Latinized version that comes from there. In the Jewish texts, in the Talmudic texts particularly, he is not called Bar Kochba. And in fact, he is called Ben Koziba. And that's significant because if I can go there, Bar Kochba actually is a Hebrew word which really means son of a star. And that relates to a messianic interpretation of Numbers 24:17, which Rabbi Akiba gives this. So he's considered to be a king messiah for this interpretation. But in the actual transcriptions, when the rabbis are reviewing this in the years later on, they actually use the Zed version, the Koziba, which means son of a lie. So when in fact you read the Talmudic accounts and you're seeing, if you transliterate what the word is, they're saying, and the son of a lie said. And that's because they're reviewing why this whole thing failed and why was it Rabbi Akiba went along with it and thought that this man was the king messiah. So to wrap this up then, Bar Kochba is what history calls him. Shimon ben Koziba is his real name. And I think we probably should remember that because that's what he called himself. There's nothing in any of the contemporary documentation which he and his administration put out that suggests he was claiming to be a messiah. In fact, what he was specifically claiming to be was Nazi Yisrael, which is to say the president, the prime minister, or the prince of Israel. So that might appeal to a sort of messianic tradition, but the Shimon is what appears in all the coins, simply Shimon.
And for the people who maybe don't know, what is Bar Kochba really famous for? What's at the core of this book?
A rebel against Rome and 3.5 years, a successful one. Trouble is, it didn't last more than the 3.5 years, and it became a spectacular catastrophe, which Jews still remember as being the cause of the diaspora. So the reason why you find Jews in Eastern, Western Europe and Northern Africa, for example, it going into the Middle Ages is traced back to this failed revolt of AD 132 to 136. It's not quite true because there were always Jews in the diaspora. I mean, there were always Jews in Rome and Babylon and other places. But in the sort of narrative that came out from this, the banning of the Jews from Jerusalem, which was one of the direct consequences of this failed revolt, it is seen as being the cause of this, the spreading of the Jewish people away from the promised land, the Holy Land, if you will. So I think that's probably the crux. That's the key reason. That's why Jews remember him. Historically, you could say that that's probably true to a point, but not an entire truth.
It's fair to say probably that the earlier revolt is far more famous the one that was struck down by Vespasian and his sons in but pretty much during the same time as we just recently discussed on the podcast about the Batavian revolt, and the end of the Second Temple era. And the reason probably is, as so often, is we've got better sources. And this one, we know very little about, it seems, at least until now, because you seem to have done an enormous amount of work digging up sources and bits and pieces. Sorry, Mark, I think you wanted to ask this question too, but it was on my mind. How do we know about it? Because there's, you know, we don't have a Josephus. We don't have Tacitus. We don't have those outlines. It's not an era that's particularly well preserved in Cassius Dio, I think.
But you know what, though, Jasper, as we know from every podcast we do, that isn't that typical of ancient history from the earliest times.
That's true.
You know, so you deal with the hand that you're dealt, right? And you dig around, and it's amazing. So if I can go through very briefly, so book 69 of Cassius Dio gives you about sort of two chapters, which, to all intents and purposes, follow the narrative of the war and give some sort of idea of the causes. The contemporary, you've got, for example, Appian, who actually mentions specifically that he sort of says these things happening in my own time, which is very interesting because that confirms that. You've got the letters, for example, of Fronto, who actually is writing to Marcus Aurelius and refers to the losses of troops, you know, by your grandfather, you know, sort of thing. So you take these types of things plus the Historia Augusta from the Roman side, and you begin to sort of tease out what important things are. I mentioned some of the Jewish sources. There's a rabbinic tradition that the Talmud. There are two versions of Talmud, which are sort of commentaries of biblical texts seen through contemporary events. And what that helps people to understand is the ancient Hebrew Bible through modern times, and those give you clues about what's happening. At least it's, we think, contemporaneously. But as you begin to understand the way that book is put together, it's a dynamic book. It sort of is augmented with each age, and sometimes it seems to be that people are going back in time and changing things. So you have to approach that one with care. I mentioned the Christian histories earlier, and I also mentioned the letters and the coins. And there's archaeology. I mean, that there are literally places, right? You can go to these places, and just by looking at the data that the archaeologists produce, you know, you can see that this place was a fortified village, that it was actually subject to fire, and the burn layers with coins trapped in this clearly is dated to the what's sometimes called the Second Jewish War, the Bar Kokhba revolt. And it's the adding together of all of these things that enables you to see the evidence, and you try and navigate a path through that, being always cognizant that this is subject to interpretation. And of course, sometimes the actual evidence itself. I mean, for example, Cassius Dio is writing 100 years after the event. The rabbinic sources are writing contemporaneous, or even 1,000 years after the event. And the result of that is that you know, you just have to be a little bit, you know, careful. Sometimes you can't take things necessarily literally true. But to your exact point, there is no Josephus, which is also a blessing, by the way, because if you think about it, we really only have Josephus to tell you about the first Jewish war. And you know, there's a whole literature of books trying to critique that, and that has its own disadvantages as well as positives.
Yeah, it's true. You can be tricked by it.
Lindsay, if I could ask, why was there a revolt at all?
That's a very good question. Let's start from the very beginning. it really is. And so, for example, what I was able to find out really that the ancient sources themselves are a bit mixed on the subject. And if you, for example, look at people like Appian, he seems to think that it's tied to the rebuilding of Jerusalem, which, as we said earlier, was destroyed during 70 under Titus and Vespasian. And you have to imagine, from 70 to 130, it's basically a ruin. Although the archaeology is beginning to suggest that there was already building activity. In fact, that the plaza in front below the Western Wall seems to have been laid out. There were things already happening there. The inference being that about a decade before the revolt, Jerusalem was being rebuilt. And this seems to be part of what Hadrian does. He sort of sees wonderful opportunities for urban revival right across the empire. And he may have gone to Jerusalem perhaps soon after he came to the throne, if you want to call it that, in 117, it's not clear. And it seems to be that the instructions were given to start building the city. And, you know, It's a beautiful location. It's very high up. It's very sort of theatrical. And it just was crying out for his sort of artistic sensibilities to deal with it. So rebuilding the city is the one thing that there is in both the rabbinic tradition, but also in a Christian history, the suggestion that Hadrian was actually quite willing to actually rebuild a third temple. And what happened was the Jews were double-crossed. In fact, he didn't fulfill his promise. So they felt very aggrieved about that. And related to that, this, in fact, was not just going to be any old city, not like a municipium. It's going to be Colonia. So it's going to be where former retired Roman soldiers go. So what that effectively will do is completely change the style and the feel of the city from being a Jewish center to being a sort of just another Colonia, which has got lots of nice buildings. But crucially, it's got the triad. It's got the Capitoline triad of the Roman gods, and its name itself obliterates any sort of hint of its glorious past in calling Colonia Ilia Capitolina. So by linking it to his own family, Ilia, or Ilias in this case, and Capitolina, which are the Capitoline triad, it seems to be a deliberate attempt to remake this into an occupier's city, if you will, I suppose. So that seems to be the leading candidate. The other ones include, for example, eliminating circumcision. Castration was illegal, but there's only one source for the circumcision, which is the Historia Augusta. So there's some question mark as to whether that's true. And there are things like, for example, banning the reading and study of Torah. There are bans on Shabbat and these types of things. A lot of the secondary suggestions may, in fact, be later additions and interpretations. So my own view, having studied everything, seems to be it's really the rebuilding of the city and or the breaking of a promise to rebuild a third temple, which never happens.
Why would the rebuilding of the city be so objectionable?
It just simply because of the profound importance of Jerusalem to the Jewish faith. I mean, that there were other places where there were temples, but it seems to have been very early on that the Jerusalem temple acquired this mystique of being the main place. And in fact, the whole temple culture leading up to 70 AD really changed how Judaism was performed. I mean, it was the Pharisees and the traditions and the sacrifices and all of these sorts of things, all of which stopped very abruptly after 70, because if there was no temple to actually do these ceremonies and rituals, it meant that everything had to be done locally. And this is where the rabbis begin to sort of really take over the direction of the religion. So the fact that somebody else effectively is taking that city and paganizing it in our way of looking at it nowadays was anathema, was a great insult. I mean, you get the impression, had they just left it as a ruin, that would be okay. And in fact, for the Samaritans, the Kuthites in Jewish tradition, I mean, they had their own ruined temple, which had never been built on in their part of the world. So that was okay. But the fact that egregiously Hadrian decides to build it in a sort of Hellenistic Roman-style city, which is going to be occupied by people who used to, you know, be the troops that policed and occupied Judea, would seem to have been, you know, very egregious.
The rebels employed asymmetric warfare in combat with the Romans. What is asymmetric warfare? Why did they choose that type of war to fight?
Well, I think this is one of the things that's intriguing. It sort of hints at the man himself, Bar Kokhba or Shimon ben Kozeba. We know nothing about him, frankly. I mean, he's a man who apparently comes from the south. There's hints that maybe he was somehow involved in sort of shepherding or this sort of thing. He was literate. He could speak right Hebrew. And he sort of had an understanding of Judaism from a religious perspective in all of its holy days. But as a commander, all we have really is the clues in, for example, Cassius Dio and the letters that survive. And what we seem to see there is that it's realized very early on, you do not take the Romans into the field and deal with them there. That's not how they're going to win. It had been proved over and over, for example, during the first Jewish war, that a sort of guerrilla style war is more likely to actually get you victories. And you want to avoid being held up in sort of citadels because the Romans will besiege you in citadels. That's of course how Josephus got caught, didn't he? So what they do in fact is convert their villages into sort of fortified enclaves, and take the war underground. So there was already a tradition for having caverns and cisterns and something, but what they seem to have done was taken it to the logical extent as using that place from which to launch attacks. And if you look at a lot of the ancient histories, you'll find that there are tiny little Jewish villages all across Judea. And it's mainly to put this in context, we're not talking about the Galilee or Samaria. We're mainly talking about Judea. So that, think about the Dead Sea going west across the Judean Shephelah and going down south towards the Judean desert. That's the terrain we're talking about. So the ground is basically a sort of limestone, chalky limestone construction. It's kind of easy to dig in. So people would actually be storing food and dairy products and so on underground. The logical thing was that you could store arms and equipment, you could store people, and from there you can launch attacks. And what's very clear is that from Cassius Dio, by doing that, they wreak havoc with the Romans, because first of all, they don't seem to understand quite how extensive this revolt is. And when they do, they're unable, it's a game of whack-a-mole. I mean, the people come and they disappear. And it does seem to be that part of the driver for all of this is that there's recognition that you cannot take the Romans on face value, you know, head on. You have to find another way. And asymmetry, which seems to be, if you look through all the history of revolts and revolutions in Roman history, it's invariably that's what the warlord does. Some part of it's got to be down to sheer numbers. I mean, they may not be able to match the numbers. And if they can, then of course you're dealing with professional soldiers as opposed to maybe semi-professional. That the likelihood is what Bar Kokhba had was militia, village people, farmers, maybe some townsfolk, who, you know, trained or used weapons as and when they were. But these were not professional troops. I mean, they were not.
And yet they were quite successful doing that, I think. I mean, there are some indications that the Romans suffered pretty heavy losses during this war.
That is exactly the text, almost word for word, what Fronto writes. That they actually say that there were many, many casualties. Of course, that's a vague number. You know, it's a hint of something catastrophic. And it may all be in relative terms. And the fact that any Roman life was lost at all, maybe, you know, that more than one is already a big problem. I'm just reminded, for example, of Afghanistan, where NATO just pulled out of. I mean, you've got a similar sort of asymmetry of warfare there. And I think what it highlights is if you have knowledge of terrain, and you're clever in how you go about using knowledge of that, and the light-footedness that a lightly armed fighter can bring, you can wreak havoc on a well-organized heavy infantry.
What were the chances of success in the long term of the Bar Kokhba revolt? Does it have anything to do with possible Parthian intervention? Had Parthia been stronger, might there have been a better chance for success?
Well, I'm going to say, of course, I think with the benefit of 2020 vision, of course, the chance was zero. In fact, one of my Jewish friends, when he read my first book for Osprey, he said he was an idiot. But you know what? What's interesting, you could argue that people like Viriatus was an idiot, too. I mean, Viriatus, for example, in Lusitania, won, except he got assassinated. So, you know, that was unfortunate. What finally, I think, drew the nail in the coffin here was that the strategy changed. We'll talk about that later. That the traditional Roman doctrine of bring them into the open field, let's fight them, was switched, and we'll talk about that later. But what I see as part of the inspiration here is not Parthia being weak, because there's no indication that Bar Kokhba and his Jewish followers had any connection at all with Parthia. In fact, you know, I don't necessarily see why they would need one. In fact, between them and Parthia's Arabia Petraea, it's a Roman province on the other side of the Dead Sea. And in fact, there are people, there are Jews leaving there to come to the Free People's Republic, if you will, of Israel, because that's what he gives his name to the country. He doesn't call it Judea or Zion. He actually calls it Israel, just interesting enough. I think if anything explains it, he probably finds inspiration from the Maccabees and how they asked the Seleucids. And what's very interesting there is that it's similar kind of parallels. I mean, you've got a professional army, heavy infantry type of thing. And it takes an act of outrage, if you will, the erection of a statue of Zeus on the temple mount that causes Judah Maccabee to say enough already. They use all the techniques of the guerrilla fighter to oust the Seleucids, ending, of course, with the Battle of Adar in 161. And that succeeded. almost against all the odds. I mean, the Seleucid kings, the Hashmoneans, go all the way through to basically the time of Pompey. So if you were an optimist, you would, and you didn't know a lot about Roman history, but you know a lot about your own country's history, you would take, I think, inspiration from that.
So how did they take it down in the end? Because you're saying legions came in, doesn't work. Is it in the end, you know, to continue with the analogy with more modern day warfare, was there a surge?
Yes. So piecing together all the different the stories from the different sources, Tinius Rufus is the legate that has been appointed in 130 by Hadrian, who sits in Caesarea and seems to be an all-round kind of competent man. But when it comes to handling ground intelligence, saying that the country is on fire, doesn't seem to do very much about it. And I would imagine that you can imagine the way that the army is deployed. And they have about 15 auxiliary units deployed across the Judea, province of Judea. They have two permanent legions, 6 for Arta and 10 for Tensis. And I would imagine the doctrine is the centurions, the tribunes will sort this out. It's a local issue. You know, they will just quash the thing. And as the situation gets worse, they'll send word and I will deploy the troops. And what's really interesting is the fact that the 6 for Arta seems not to have been involved. At least there's no evidence that suggests it was, but 10 for Tensis was. So that puts the conflict pretty much down in the south of the province. And what he seems to do is throw everything he's got, and it doesn't seem to actually bring him any benefits. The shock and awe doesn't work in that regard. And he takes casualties, and these are probably the casualties that Fronta refers to. And at some point, he must appeal to his neighbors in Syria and Arabia Petraea. And it is the structure, in a sense, that goes all the way back to Caesar Augustus, where you have these provincial armies, and the governor of any particular location, presumably to short-circuit the transmission lines, can appeal to his neighbors and say, I need your help. Can you send me some troops? And in this particular case, troops arrive from Arabia Petraea and they arrive from Syria in some numbers. One is a full legion, in fact. So at this point, that means you've got 3 full legions, 15 auxiliaries, and some cohorts from other places in the initial phase. But their deployment using standard doctrine, which is to go bring these people into the open, doesn't seem to work. Let's burn everything we see in sight. That doesn't work either. And in the meantime, the contrast is the Jews are actually taking Roman coins and overstamping them with their own marks. So in fact, a coin of the Flavian Vespasian actually is now suddenly showing a lyre and Shimon, and these are pouring out of villages and mints. So the Jewish side of things is it's working great, right? And the Romans don't seem to be able to penetrate this. And what you find is, and I think your question earlier was about what changed, it seems to be that Hadrian takes the decision that Tinius Rufus is incompetent, can't handle it, he needs a better man. And that man seems to be Julius Severus, Sextus Julius Severus, who's been the commander and the provincial governor in Britain, who it seems has already handled a revolt successfully. And we get some hint of that in Fronto, because he talks about the Britons caused havoc on the Roman troops and, oh, what a loss they caused for the Jews. And it's interesting that Fronto quotes both Jews and Britons. And significantly, in just the last decade or so, looking at London, Roman London, the archaeologists have found a burnt layer. And this isn't the Boudicca period, but burnt layer. This is like middle 120s, 125 thereabouts, which seems to suggest there was an extensive fire. And very shortly after that, the fort is built at, I forget, is it Cripplegate, I think, up where the Museum of London now exists. And there's the surrounding walls. And it seems to be that there had been some big revolt in Britain. Was it localized to any particular geography? It's not clear, but there seems to be written evidence for it and some archaeological evidence for it. Point is, Severus dealt with it. And I would imagine that what he had done has proved his ability to deal with something like this and deal with it effectively. And he is the man pinned the rose to go deal with the Bar Kokhba revolt. And in fact, it rapidly goes from being sort of revolt to being task force, Expeditio Judaicae, which means Jewish task force, and a whole sort of command structure heads down there from Upper Pannonia, from Syria. The whole Roman Empire seems to provide troops to varying degrees. But Severus is put in charge of this. He reviews at some point Tinius Rufus's strategy and decides it's really not working. I mean, a year and a half has already passed. And he starts to break up the units into much smaller units. And it would appear to be what he then does is to deploy them against individual villages. And there are, by reputation, hundreds of these things, but it becomes a tortoise and hare type of thing. where he will just simply systematically give one after the other. And the archaeology does suggest that this is what they do. And because he has strategic patience, and he now has something like, I worked up between about 30 and 50,000 troops, nine legions, either vexillations or complete ones, and all the auxiliary units, and even potentially men of the fleets from Misenum and possibly Syria as well, that he uses them in a much more granular fashion. And this is the thing that gets results. So what you now see translated into the Jewish accounts is how people start amassing and fleeing then to Batar, which is variously Bethetharah and Bethira and all sorts of other pronunciations. But we think it means Betar in Palestine now, just outside the Green Line, which is a hillfoot stronghold. And the archaeology shows that what had been a small, compact town of about 2,000 people was suddenly very quickly ring-fenced with a wall. It's a very rough-hewn wall. And the Romans then build a circumvallation wall around it, and they put two camps very close by on a hill overlooking it. And what's fascinating is I looked at some air photography done in 1923, and it was done much higher and further away. And in fact, there are a whole series of these camps. They form like triple arcs. So it's almost as though they had cornered this force to Batar, and they were not going to let this thing become another Masada. You know, it's going to take ages and ages and ages. They're going to deal with it once and for all. And at some point in 135, which is preserved in the Jewish calendar, 9th of Ab, which may be a date in August 135, but 9th of Ab is what it is, the Romans finally let loose and take the city of Betar. The significance in the Jewish tradition is this, is that the fall of the temple in AD 70 was the 9th of Ab. And Nebuchadnezzar, I can never pronounce that word, in 586 destroyed the first temple on the 9th of Ab. So there's this interesting sort of religious historical linking of three major catastrophes, which in Hebrew are called Hurban. And these three things are significant sort of points within Jewish faith, because they mark these catastrophes where, if you think about it, the temple is supposed to be the link between Jews and God. And the second Jewish war basically breaks that. And in Bar Kokhba, what you have is another man trying to reestablish that. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that he actually conquers it. And he finds his end in Betar, which ironically is now outside the state of Israel. It's actually in Palestine, possibly by design. But that seems to be what happened. And in the end, Roman siegecraft and logic and all the things that it brings to bear, with a little subtle adjustment by Sextus Julius Severus, was the thing that reduced it. But it took him 3.5 years to do it. So you can argue, as rebels go, was he successful? Yeah, for 3.5 years. Ultimately, it failed. But there's a long tail history with this thing, which goes on much longer, which we talk about. So I hope that answers your question.
Bar Kokhba finds his end there. I mean, is there anything known about, did he fight himself to death? Or?
Well, you see, we go back to the Roman sources, and this event is mentioned in two paragraphs, two chapters in Cassius Dio. He doesn't even mention the man's name. Right. So we just, you know, there's a revolt and the Jews fail, and there's this catastrophe whereby something like 580,000 people apparently are killed or injured, and the ones that are alive are captured and enslaved and shipped off through Hebron or through Gaza to become what people often think of as the diaspora. But what's important, I think, to remember is that if you look at the Jewish tradition, and you remember that the way they characterize him as being not son of a star, but son of a liar, he's not somebody that the rabbinic texts particularly want to celebrate. They look at this man and say, we were sold a lie. And all these people died trying to sort of fulfill this promise, which was a false promise. And what's fascinating is that a couple of things happened. First of all, Judaism, which in a sense had been one of the religions, communities, which was prepared to go to war against the Romans in order to establish its independence and separate identity, stops doing that after this. There's very clear evidence that Judaism starts to Romanize. I mean, the fact that that they start behaving much more in a sort of Roman fashion. There's a wonderful book, I think it's called The Rabbi and Aphrodite, where he tries to explain how, for example, in Dura Europos, there's a famous synagogue there, which has got all sorts of mythological paintings as well as everyday life type things. And it's this really strange hybrid between pagan images and Jewish images, except that, of course, under strict Judaism, you can't actually depict images. So that's interesting. So they, for example, start numbering the books and the chapters in Talmud and in Torah in a way that people would do with Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. So there's this sort of Romanizing, if you will, of Jewish culture. The Jews learned to assimilate into Roman culture. And it's also important to know that this war really only impacted probably now what we think of Judea. It didn't include the Galilee, probably, and certainly the north of the country. And it wasn't an anti-Jewish war. It was an anti-rebel war that happened to be led by a guy called Bar Kokhba in Judea. So all the Jews elsewhere were not victimized. They were not punished in a sort of way, unlike what happened in the Flavians, where they imposed a tax, the Fiscus Judicus, which in fact went on for several decades before Nerva repealed it. So Hadrian approaches this as being a local matter, dealt with locally, and it's sorted. And Jews can go about their business lawfully, and it's a recognized religion of great antiquity. And Jews can serve in the Roman army, and in fact they do. And in fact they even serve, because you mentioned earlier, Mark, about Parthia. They actually work with frontier units, serving quite honorably there too.
It's very clear from this book, it's not your first one, but that this has a more of a personal connection for you. Can we ask why that is? Is that?
Yeah, I think so. Well, history to me is personal, right? And I'm not Jewish. I don't speak Hebrew, although I've learned some since. But my best friend at school was Jewish, and that always intrigued me. I mean, you know, how can this be such a completely different sort of approach to the world and religion? Because I was brought up in Wales in a sort of like a Presbyterian tradition, you know, which is, that had its own thing. And my mother was chapel, right? So that's a very stripped down, sort of a fairly ruthless, unfrilled version of Christianity. So it's not a Catholic sort of background. And I was just really smitten by the fact of the fact that there were letters that survived from this period. I read Yigal Yadin's book as a teenager, and you know, you can't really not be enthralled when you read Yigal Yadin's book. It's filled with color pictures, and he has an ability, I think, to draw you into the story of discovery and the excitement. And of course, for him, there is a deeper message, right? Which is it's the justification of the state of Israel in 1948, as expressed through an archaeological record, which shows deep roots into the history. And as somebody made the point that Yigal Yadin was a leader of one of the resistance armies against the British in the 1947-48-49 war, and later became an archaeologist. And he wrote this sort of book. And somebody made the point, when they found these letters, it was that they delivered them to him in the sense of, here's an unbroken transmission from the previous commander of the Jewish army for you. So they make these great arcs through time. And that struck me as being extraordinary, because you've got people in the modern day anchoring their existence to something that happened 2,000 years ago in a way that I, as a Welsh person, don't. I mean, the history of Wales goes back 10,000 BC, 25,000 BC, something. It starts with Tinkin's Wood and the Red Lady and people like that. You know, but we don't have like a sort of biblical tradition that locks things down. In fact, Wales has been, you could argue, been occupied by England for 1,000 years. That's another podcast, probably. But it just struck me that this story needs to be told. And the way I told it was unusual for me, because I could have done something along the lines of A to Z or A to Z. Once upon a time, here are the facts, the end. And what I thought was much more interesting was to try and involve the reader in my journey of exploration, because there are no clear-cut answers. And what I wanted to try and explain to people is, depending on who you are, you may interpret it differently. I'll give you an example. So a rabbi wrote to me just in the last couple of weeks, and we were talking about this man, and he praised me for actually really it's bringing the personality, the persona of Bar Kokhba to the fore, but he had some issues with, you know, why I focused particularly on the fire burning thing at Lag BaOmer. Now, he being an Orthodox Jew has a totally different understanding of that. And for him, it's tied with Rebbe, which is the great rabbi who actually was a pupil of Akiba, which they celebrate year on year on year. It's a great big thing. And if you remember this year, 2021, There was a big tragedy because there were people got trapped and got killed because there was a big crowd and people got crushed. That was the rabbi these people were celebrating the death of. And they celebrate that with singing and a bonfire. And I said, well, but there's the secular Jews who, as a result of being in the diaspora in the 19th and 20th centuries, co-opted that celebration and made it the celebration of Bar Kokhba. And the reason they did that was because by then they had reinvented Bar Kokhba, not as a failed guy, as a failed guy, but as a hero, a man who stood up to the Romans and could show what was possible if you only just did it and stood up and resisted. And this time round, of course, it worked. So they actually were able to found a number of Zionist rebel groups, some of which actually had the banner and the moniker of Bar Kokhba or even Betar. And in fact, these drove all sorts of communities to try and be better than their neighbors kept on thinking of them. And I just looked at this entire story. I haven't been to Israel twice. It does get personal because, you know, you talk to people. I was in Silicon Valley last week talking to an engineer for a company in big high-tech stuff. And we got talking about my book, and he being Jewish, he sort of said, you know, that yes, he has an understanding what Bar Kokhba means to him, and he still doesn't understand why this failed man represented such an object of hope. And in fact, there's a wonderful line where there was a former intelligence officer who wrote a book, and what he basically did was to demolish the whole story of Bar Kokhba and what he called the Bar Kokhba syndrome. And he said, in war, the main thing is to win the last battle, not the first. And his point is that Bar Kokhba set off on this escapade without any idea how it would end, right? It was all very well, and this is what happens with a lot of rebels in the Roman era and arguably in every other area, is that people make the first shock strike and they kind of go off in a direction they probably haven't planned. And if they have planned, they don't know where it's going to go. And this is the classic case. But what in this particular case happened was that he got reinvented and turned into a kind of Israeli King Arthur. And to the point when coins of his appear on stamps and images of appear in stamps, there are operas about him, there are plays about him, there are novels about him. And I just wanted to get down into the weeds of this thing and understand what is the truth of this. And it was a wonderful journey because I discovered that, like with King Arthur, this person, this event of 2,000 years ago, is still real in America. It still has legs. It reaches into modern Israel, and they still celebrate Lag BaOmer, whether you're a secular Jew or whether you're Orthodox, in your slightly different ways. And, you know, we don't have anything in Britain. We don't have a certain day where we celebrate King Arthur, but they do in Israel for Bar Kokhba. And I thought that was kind of intriguing.
Mark, do you have anything to add right now? Or are we going to say there's just a couple of weeks left before Christmas and maybe this makes appropriate or not very appropriate reading, but you should try and read it anyway.
I think that everyone should read this book. Go out and get it now. It's a wonderful book, and I was proud to read it, and I'm proud to know Lindsay too, because he's a wonderful author.
Well, that's very kind. Let me ask you that. I mean, my chance to ask you, what did you like about it? Well, because for me, this was a very different way to write a book, and I agonized over this.
Well, I think you said it yourself. I like the exploratory aspect of it, that you were on a journey. So there was something I thought very much, there was a story within a story, that there was the story of Bar Kokhba, and there was a story of you, Lindsay Powell, following wherever the evidence led. And I thought that made it stand out, because you could have gone from A to Z, as I will say it, and just, you know, gone through all of the material. I think that it was spiced up, definitely. And if I could point to one very interesting thing that didn't make it into initially, but I thought it was very interesting how the rebels, they would deliberately provide the Romans, you know, under contract with inferior grade weaponry, knowing the Romans would reject these weapons, and then they would take these weapons for themselves so they could actually have something to fight with. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, is it the only place that comes from is Cassius Dio, right? And so then you sort of say, okay, did the supply chain really rely on that? Yes, that the Roman army did issue requisitions for things. And, you know, the Frisians, for example, had to supply skins and cows and milk and stuff like this. So it's a reminder that the Roman army really relies on the local community for providing it. The big surprise is that it's arms and armor, right? And we do have examples that survive in caves, there are spears, and that the Jews are very good at repurposing weapons and that type of thing. So they started the war with basically tunics and wooden shields, and by the end they'd accumulated this Roman material that they'd captured. And this is how history is made, isn't it? When you tease out these little details and you then feed it into the bigger picture. I also want to add that it was not an opportunity for me to write about Hadrian. So I was actually finishing my book about Augustus, and it was David Mevorah in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem said to me that Hadrian was a student of Augustus. And what's very intriguing is how so much of what Hadrian did was in fact to replicate and to implement what the predecessor of a full century before had done. And what's extraordinary is that all of this could be completely avoided. And the mystery is why did Hadrian bullheadedly do what he did at the great cost that it caused him? Because interesting enough, the war ends 135, 136, and 2 years later, he's dead.
For someone who was so deeply immersed in Hellenic philosophy, an intelligent man, he made apparently a very terrible decisions regarding that area, and it kicked off the war.
Well, my interpretation is that he saw Jerusalem as being a marvelous blank canvas on which to do amazing things, and on the trips out around the Roman world, particularly to the east, he was seeing Antioch and Petra and Palmyra and all these wonderful places, and said, "I can build my own, and it'll have my name on it." You know, it's a wonderful piece of ancient branding. But to the damn everybody else. I mean, I'm the chief guy. I can do this. And what's interesting again, if you look at the coins, and there's some beautiful coins in gold and silver, the Romans mint. He doesn't take the same Judea Capta line that the Flavians did and continued for like a decade and a half to do. These are rather obtuse appeals to Victoria Augusta and, you know, Victoriolas on hands and so on. So there's a general sense of there's a victory's taking place, and my face is on the side, so it's my victory. He builds an arch. He honors his three generals. He takes the title Imperator II, so he actually only has that twice after this. But there are many, many questions, many, many mysteries. So one day maybe I'll write a sequel.
So there you have it. It's a story of the historian network, really, and a people story. And what's better than that? Thanks very much.